and VOA's Joe Ramsey with this worldwide news update. U.S. President Donald Trump said Thursday that he's confident Russian President Vladimir Putin will not push to restart the war in Ukraine if a truce is reached, AP correspondent Sagar Magani reports.
In the Oval Office,
I think he'll keep his word.
The president says he's known Putin for a long time and does not believe Putin will go back on his word.
History must be on the side of the peacemaker, not the invader.
The president spoke alongside British Prime Minister Keir Starmer, the second European leader to visit the White House this week, amid concerns on the continent about the president perhaps conceding too much to Putin in an aggressive push to end the war. Sagar Magani, Washington.
Ukrainian President Volodymyr Zelensky visits the White House on Friday. Zelensky and Trump are expected to sign off on a contentious agreement that would give the U.S. access to Ukraine's critical minerals. Egypt says negotiations between Israel and Hamas on the next phase of the Gaza ceasefire have begun in Cairo. Egypt's State Information Service said officials from Israel, Qatar, and the U.S. on Thursday started intensive discussions on the second phase of the ceasefire. An Israeli official had said earlier in the day that Israel's military will not withdraw from a strategic corridor in the Gaza Strip. The pullout was part of the ceasefire, and Israel's refusal could spark a crisis with Hamas and key mediator Egypt at a sensitive moment for a fragile truce. The Israeli official spoke hours after Hamas released the remains of four hostages in exchange for over 600 Palestinian prisoners, the last planned exchange of the ceasefire's first phase, which ends this weekend. This is VOA News. Top officials from the U.S. and several other member states skipped a group of 20 major economies finance ministers meeting in South Africa this week, raising questions about the group's continued relevance. Kate Bartlett reports from Johannesburg.
The two-day meeting in Cape Town ended without a communique, with current G20 leader South Africa saying there was not sufficient consensus to issue one. In his opening remarks at the event, South African President Cyril Ramaphosa referred to the fractured geopolitical climate and stressed the importance of international cooperation.
At this time of global uncertainty and escalating tension, it is now more important than ever that the members of the G20 should work together.
But it appeared the world's largest economies were not able to find common ground on a number of issues. The finance ministers' meeting was beset with similar problems faced by last week's G20 foreign ministers' meeting in Johannesburg, which laid bare the discord in current geopolitics. U.S. Treasury Secretary Scott Bessent skipped the event amid a spat with host country South Africa and after the U.S. criticized the themes around climate change and solidarity, equality, and sustainability. Kate Bartlett, VOA News, Johannesburg.
President Trump said on Thursday that his proposed 25% tariffs on Mexican and Canadian goods will go into effect on March 4th and threaten an extra 10% duty on Chinese imports over what he said were drugs pouring into the U.S. from those countries. Reuters correspondent Alex Cohen has more.
Canadian and Mexican officials were due to meet with Trump administration counterparts in Washington on Thursday and Friday to try to forestall the tariffs, which could deal a serious blow to a highly integrated North American economy. Trump's comments on the matter during his first cabinet meeting on Wednesday seemed to suggest that he may push the deadline back for about 1 month until April 4th.
Reuters correspondent Alex Cohen. A search warrant shows that Oscar-winning actor Gene Hackman, his wife, and one of their dogs had been dead for some time before being discovered. AP correspondent Donna Warder reports.
A maintenance worker entered the couple's Santa Fe, New Mexico home Wednesday and found their bodies. They say one of their dogs, a German Shepherd, was found dead in the bathroom closet. But two other dogs, one inside the home and one outside, were found alive and well. A sheriff's detective says the couple didn't have any wounds and that there were no signs of a carbon monoxide leak or carbon monoxide poisoning. I'm Donna Warder.
That wraps up this update, but the world and news never stop. For additional updates, visit our website, voanews.com. I'm Joe Ramsey, VOA News.
morning, Africa. Welcome to Daybreak Africa from the Voice of America. I'm James Botti in Washington. Today's Friday, February 28th, and here are some of the stories we are covering. An explosion Thursday at an M23 rally in the eastern DRC city of Bukavu has killed 11 people and injured 65 others.
I saw a tweet from Bertrand Bisimwa, who is the head of M23, saying that they will do a serious investigation and the authors of this attack will pay for what they did.
Splinters within the international community are evident at a G20 finance ministers meeting in South Africa. The WHO Framework Convention on Tobacco Control marked its 20th anniversary Thursday. Ethiopia's Prime Minister Abiy Ahmed visited neighboring Somalia Thursday to improve relations.
Two countries are trying to normalize and restore their relationship to what it was before. They realize that as neighbors, they need to have good relationships with one another. So going forward, we should see normalization of relationships.
And Trump hosts British Prime Minister for Ukraine-focused talks. Those stories plus Samson O'Malley Sports are coming up on Daybreak Africa. The United Nations, along with its partners in the Democratic Republic of Congo government, on Thursday launched a $2.5 billion humanitarian response plan for the people of Eastern DRC. UN spokesperson Stéphane Dujarric says the plan seeks $2.5 billion this year to provide life-saving assistance and protection for 11 million people, including 7.8 million internally displaced in DRC. Meanwhile, an explosion on Thursday at an M23 rally in the eastern city of Bukavu killed 11 people and injured 65 others, according to Reuters news agency. Reporter Al-Katanti Sabati Jaffa in Goma tells me that the M23 is vowing retaliation for the explosion.
February 27, leaders of AFC and M23 faced for the first time the public of the city of Bukavu, which is the capital city of the South Kivu province, in a meeting where thousands of people were welcoming this rebellion. But unfortunately, at the end of this meeting, an explosion which killed several people and injured others made end to this rally.
Initial reports say 11 people were killed and many more injured. Are there any new developments in terms of the casualties?
The spokesperson of the DRC government, the Minister of Communication, Patrick Muyaya, announced that 11 people were killed during this explosion and several were injured and are getting care in the Bukavu hospital. But at the end of the day, the General Hospital of Bukavu announced the death of two more people, which makes the record of 13 people killed and 73 injured.
Do we know who might have carried out this attack and was he or she apprehended?
At the moment, it's a bit difficult to know or to talk about who could be the author of this attack on the M23 rally, because M23 is pointing the DRC government and the Burundian soldiers. But also at his side, the DRC government is pointing M23 of exposing and killing local population of Bukavu, since M23 is the one who is in control of the city of Bukavu. But let me tell you that since yesterday, there is an audio who trends in different WhatsApp groups and other social media, signed by a leader of Wazalendo groups from Uvira, who were calling locals of Bukavu to do not go at the M23 rally because they will do a sabotage on it. We can't know or be sure that the sabotage spoken in that audio was this bombing attack or not. But at the moment, all parties are pointing at it.
Why was the M23 having this rally in the first place? And what is the M23 saying now after the attack?
I saw a tweet from Bertrand Bisimwa, who is the head of M23 and the vice coordinator of AFC, saying that they will do a serious investigation and the authors of this attack will pay for what they did.
That was reporter Jafar Alkatanti speaking with us from Goma in the Eastern Democratic Republic of Congo. Somalia's state media reports that Ethiopia's Prime Minister Abiy Ahmed was in the country's capital, Mogadishu, on Thursday to hold discussions with President Hassan Sheikh Mohamed. The visit follows what analysts say is a thaw in icy relations between the two neighbors. The relations is sour in January 2024 when Ethiopia announced plans to lease a stretch of coastline in the Somalia's breakaway Somaliland region. Edgar Gitua is an international security and diplomatic expert at the U.S. International University in Nairobi. He tells viewers Douglas Mpuga that the two countries realize that as neighbors, they need to have good relations.
I'll be visiting Somalia because the two countries are trying to normalize and restore their relationship to what it was before. They realize that as neighbors, they need to have good relationships with one another. So going forward, we should see normalization of relationships, and the diplomatic spat that they had before will definitely probably gradually come to an end, and they'll come to an understanding. What that means for Somaliland is that you might find Abiy not going through with the agreement or the leasing of the port and actually partially recognizing Somaliland, because that was in direct violation of international law, and that was interference with Somalia's internal sovereignty. So that could be a signal that going forward, you might see Ethiopia going slow on their MOU for the bad report at Somaliland.
What credit should be given to Turkey? Because some analysts have said AU had failed to have the two countries reconcile, but somehow they seem to be moving forward with this arrangement.
So, number one of the things that is also making Ethiopia move quickly to normalize its relationship with Somalia is, remember, Egypt has become very close to Somalia, and Egypt is an enemy of Ethiopia because of the Grand Renaissance Ethiopian Dam. So it is very possible that Prime Minister Abiy might have looked at the geopolitics and understood that if he does not mend fences with Somalia and Egypt send forces into Somalia like they had promised to do, he will have clear and present danger right at his doorstep because of the remember, the Egyptians have threatened Ethiopia that if they do not regulate the flow of the water on the River Nile from that point, they had threatened they are going to go to war and bomb it. I think Abiy has realized he's getting cornered, and if he does not normalize the relationship with Somalia, he'll be in problems with Egypt. Number two, Turkey has a lot of interest in Somalia. Turkey is very interested in the Indian Ocean, getting access to the Indian Ocean route there because of the trade routes, the Red Sea and the port, the Gulf of Aden around that area. So Turkey is definitely a big player, and Turkey is not a small country. Turkey is a regional power. Also, Turkey could also be behind this move to normalize relations between Ethiopia and Somalia so that they cut out Egypt from the geopolitics and trying to gain a foothold into Somalia, but because that's what Egypt has been trying to do of late.
Ethiopia's main concern being landlocked was access to the sea. Do you think the two could strike a deal that would meet that aspiration?
Yes, that is very, very true, because remember, even for Somalia, the biggest question the Somalia government has asked itself is, why did Ethiopia go to Somaliland? Because they want access to the sea. And so, if we can promise Ethiopia, instead of leasing from Somaliland, come and lease from us, if they can come to an agreement, Ethiopia would be happy because, number one, Somalia is the legitimate de facto government of that region. So getting the region through Somalia would be much easier and much better, and diplomatically even put Ethiopia much better. So it is very easy that that is one of the things that they're going to talk about. And for Somalia to remove that impetus and that momentum that Somaliland was gaining by getting recognition from Ethiopia, Somalia would easily cede and give. Because remember, it has the longest coastline in Africa, over 1,000 kilometers of coastline. So it would easily give out a small part of the coast to Ethiopia in exchange for Ethiopia not dealing with Somaliland, so that it becomes easier for Somalia to deal with Somaliland's internal issues.
Edgar Gitua is an international security and diplomatic expert at the U.S. International University in Nairobi. He spoke from Nairobi with viewers Douglas Mpuga. You are listening to Daybreak Africa on the Voice of America. I'm James Butte in Washington. Today is Friday, February 28th. For more African news and features, visit our website at voaafrica.com. Connect with us on all social media platforms. We are on Facebook, Twitter, and Instagram. Still to come on our program, Samson O'Malley Sports. The group of 20 major economies has been instrumental in coordinating the response to crises like the COVID pandemic, but top officials from the U.S. and several other member states skipped the G20 finance ministers' meeting in South Africa this week, raising questions about the group's continued relevance in a splinter global environment. Kate Butler reports from Johannesburg.
The two-day meeting in Cape Town ended without a communique, with current G20 leader South Africa saying there was not sufficient consensus to issue one. In his opening remarks at the event, South African President Cyril Ramaphosa referred to the fractured geopolitical climate and stressed the importance of international cooperation.
At this time of global uncertainty and escalating tension, it is now more important than ever that the members of the G20 should work together. The erosion of multilateralism presents a threat to global growth and stability.
He said the G20 finance ministers' meeting had to address major issues like climate change financing, ensuring debt sustainability for developing countries, and Africa's need to process its own critical minerals for inclusive growth. But it appeared the world's largest economies were not able to find common ground on a number of issues. South African Finance Minister Enoch Godongwana noted this wasn't the first time.
The issue of the communique and the absence thereof is not something new. To my knowledge, I mean, since the Russia-Ukraine war, it has been difficult to find a joint communique. Now, new differences have emerged on a number of other topics.
Climate adaptation funding was one of the areas where there was a difference of opinion, he said. The finance ministers' meeting was beset with similar problems faced by last week's G20 foreign ministers' meeting in Johannesburg, which laid bare the discord in current geopolitics. U.S. Treasury Secretary Scott Bessent skipped the event amid a spat with host country South Africa and after the U.S. criticized the themes around climate change and solidarity, equality, and sustainability. The finance chiefs of other large economies, including Japan, India, and China, also sat it out. However, all of them, including the U.S., sent representation at various levels. Still, the absence of some top officials underscores global divisions sparked by Russia's attack on Ukraine and the America First administration of U.S. President Trump, said Professor Alex Vandenheffer.
And I think that this has caused a sort of a general review of how people see global issues, with people becoming a lot more insular and not really looking at sort of global social solidarity in any way of shape or form, largely looking to look after their own situation.
However, Britain's Chancellor of the Exchequer, Rachel Reeves, who was in Cape Town for the meeting, added to Ramaphosa's call for unity, posting on social media platform X, quote, "productive and successful collaboration with our international partners is front of mind now more than ever." And asked about the issue of tariffs, Godongwana said there had been, quote, "general agreement against protectionism" at the G20 meeting. Kate Bartlett, VOA News, Johannesburg.
More than a quarter of the world's population is now covered by bans on smoking indoors and in workplaces. This is according to the World Health Organization, which says that the move is saving millions of lives from secondhand smoke. Since the implementation of the Framework Convention on Tobacco Control 20 years ago, 5.6 billion people are now covered by at least one tobacco control policy in line with the treaty. Maureen Ojiambo reports from Nairobi.
The World Health Organization's Framework Convention on Tobacco Control was the world's first ever public health treaty that is responsible for saving millions of lives across the world. WHO's Director General Tedros Ghebreyesus, as they said, there had been decline in global smoking rates.
20 years ago today, on the 27th of February 2005, it entered into force. The convention marks a milestone in international law and public health, with 183 parties covering 90% of the world's population. Since the convention entered into force, it's estimated that tobacco use has declined by one-third globally, There are an estimated 118 million fewer tobacco users today than 20 years ago.
Research shows that tobacco production reduces vital resources such as land and water, diverting from the substantial food production. The WHO says more than 66 countries have implemented bans on tobacco advertising, promotion, and sponsorship. Tedros says tobacco has claimed many lives as it causes many chronic illnesses, among them heart disease and other forms of cancer.
We have come a long way in the fight against tobacco, but we still have a long way to go. Tobacco continues to kill millions of people each year. It's the main driver of preventable death. We urge all parties to remain vigilant against the deceptive tactics of the tobacco industry. We call on all parties to strengthen implementation of the convention.
The WHO says the tobacco industry continues to undermine public health efforts, aggressively targeting youth through marketing and lobbying against tobacco control policies. Adriana Blanco is the head of the World Health Organization Framework Convention on Tobacco Control Secretariat.
As we celebrate 20 years of the entry into force of the WHO FCTC, there is no doubt that this treaty has played a pivotal role in saving millions of lives, but it also had impact on those who have negotiated the treaty itself.
The WHO's Framework Convention on Tobacco Control has been instrumental in establishing legal defenses in the face of campaigns by the tobacco industry, which spent billions of dollars to promote their products. For VOA Africa, I am Maureen Ojiambo in Nairobi.
Kenyan lawmaker and opposition veteran Martha Karua launched a new political party on Thursday, vowing to engage the youth as she prepares a run for the presidency in 2027. A fierce critic of President William Ruto, she said her new People's Liberation Party aims to fight, unite, and liberate Kenya, according to the French news agency. President Donald Trump hosted British Prime Minister Keir Starmer Thursday at the White House, where the two laid out their visions for the end of Ukraine's brutal three-year war. The staunch allies also sparred over trade and tariffs, and Trump revived his first-term push for NATO allies to contribute more to their own security and rely less on American support. VOA White House correspondent Anita Powell reports from Washington.
U.S. President Donald Trump and British Prime Minister Keir Starmer, the leaders of two nations that formed a special relationship while pushing Nazis and fascists off the battlefields of World War II, met Thursday at the White House to discuss the looming threat, eight decades later, of war in Europe as Russia's full-scale invasion of Ukraine enters a fourth year. Trump emphasized his condition for supporting Ukraine. On Friday, he said he will host Ukraine's president to lay out a preliminary deal that gives the U.S. a share of the nation's critical raw materials.
The American taxpayers will now effectively be reimbursed for the money and hundreds of billions of dollars poured into helping Ukraine defend itself, which by and of itself is a very worthy thing to do.
Starmer said the pair discussed a plan for peace that is tough but fair and backed by strength to deter future Russian aggression. He also said he was ready to put boots on the ground and planes in the air to support a deal. And in answer to Trump's demand that NATO members boost defense spending to 5% of GDP, Starmer said he agreed Europe had to step up. Earlier in the week, he announced an unexpected increase that still falls far short of Trump's benchmark. He also set his conditions for a fair settlement.
It can't be peace that rewards the aggressor or that gives encouragement to regimes like Iran. We agree history must be on the side of the peacemaker, not the invader. So the stakes, they couldn't be higher. And we're determined to work together to deliver a good deal.
Unity is key, analysts say, but there will be challenges. Michael O'Hanlon is a senior fellow at the Brookings Institution.
The most important thing, do these guys get along? Do they have a common vision? Can they maintain some sense of common purpose? Can they avoid the kind of divisive rhetoric that President Trump used a lot last week when he was so pejorative towards President Zelensky of Ukraine? And can we begin to see a Western strategy really emerging that all major countries in NATO can agree to?
Meanwhile, Russian President Vladimir Putin, who spent his day at the Kremlin hosting a high-ranking North Korean delegation, rejects the idea of peacekeepers in Ukraine. South Korea's spy agency reported Thursday that Pyongyang appears to have sent additional troops to assist Russia on Ukraine's battlefields. Putin said Thursday that there is a mutual readiness for Moscow and Washington to further cooperate after Trump recently reached out directly. He also blamed Western elites for trying to disrupt the blossoming relationship. Trump has said they will meet in Saudi Arabia, but has set no date. Anita Powell, VOA News, Washington.
It is time now for Daybreak Africa Sports, and here is Samson Omale in Abuja, Nigeria. A very good Friday morning to you, Samson.
Good Friday morning to you too, James. We begin the sport with the Confederation of African Football holding a high-level consultative meeting in Kampala, Uganda, bringing together key stakeholders from the three African Nations Championship, popularly known as CHAN 2024 co-hosting nations, Kenya, Uganda, and Tanzania. The meeting assessed progress on hosting preparations following a series of CAF inspection visits, with Kenya's review conducted on the 22nd to the 23rd of February, Uganda's on the 25th to the 26th of February, and Tanzania's scheduled for the 27th to the 28th of February. The discussions focused on finalizing the hosting agreement, securing government guarantees, structuring local organizing committees, and addressing governance issues involving CAF, host governments, LOCs, and national federations. Kenya's delegation was led by Principal Secretary for Sports, Peter Tum, who also chairs the Regional Technical Committee for the CHAN 2024 tournament and AFCON 2027 tournament.
Even as we undertake the planning, the issues to do with payment of the hosting fee we've cleared. Each country now is going to organize to do the payment. The preparation in our stadia also have been confirmed because we have had assessments from CAF in Kenya and Uganda, and they have told us that we are good to go.
Peter Owang is the Uganda sports minister.
All three countries have different laws in as far as immigration matters are concerned, but jointly, our technical committee, chaired by the permanent secretary of Kenya, will be able to work with these colleagues to ensure that we have seamless travel funds both in and out of the three countries.
Tanzanian Minister of Information John Waluko spoke on plans for seamless border movements during the championships.
In the case of East Africa, we have a joint passport, the East African passport, delivered in each respective country, but ordinary citizens on the borders can be allowed to travel with special traveling documents.
Six South African athletes will represent the country at the 2025 Special Olympics World Winter Games in Turin, Italy. The International Multisports Event is the world's largest sports organization for athletes with intellectual disabilities. The South African team was given an official send-off in Johannesburg on Thursday. This will be the 12th edition of the Special Olympics World Winter Games, where South Africa will participate in figure and speed skating. In volleyball news, this year's Africa Zone 5 Volleyball Club Championship has kicked off at the Lugogo and Old Kampala Indoor Arenas with 16 clubs from Uganda, Rwanda, Kenya, Tanzania, and South Sudan competing for the title. And that does it for this Friday's edition of Daybreak Africa Sports. I am Samson Omale in Abuja, Nigeria. It's back to you, James, in Washington.
Thank you, Samson. Have a nice weekend. And that's it for this Friday, February 28th edition of Daybreak Africa. We thank you for spending your week with us. For more African news and features, visit our website at voaafrica.com. Contact with us on all social media platforms, including Facebook, Twitter, and Instagram. We are also on YouTube, where you can watch our TV shows, Africa 54, Straight Talk Africa, and Red Carpet. On behalf of the Daybreak Africa team, I'm James Barty in Washington, wishing that you will have a great weekend. We'll see you again on Monday morning.
Has a wide variety of programs for you. News, lifestyle, health, politics, youth, women, sports, we have it all. Tune into our discussion shows on the radio, television, and the internet on voaafrica.com.